Welcome to Backyard Oasis, a podcast designed by and for older adults living in the beautiful Pioneer Valley of Western Massachusetts and produced in the tech studios at Greenfield Community College in Greenfield, Massachusetts. Backyard Oasis reaches out to older adults who seek knowledge to help them live more thoughtfully, healthily, and happily, who hope to inspire others with their ideas, and who serve their communities in the interest of the greater good. We hope you join us frequently in our pleasant backyard oasis for wide-ranging conversations with a diversity of people who are growing older and want to talk about it. Hi, this is Dennis Lee. Thanks for joining us for the Backyard Oasis podcast. My guest today is registered nurse Priscilla Ross, with a career focused on home care, hospice, and transitions of care. And as executive director of visiting nurses and hospice of Cooley Dickinson Hospital in Northampton, she was part of the team that provided education around advanced care directives, medical advanced care directives, a lot of planning in people's futures. We're going to talk about that a lot. There's all kinds of programs, but we'll get into that. But before we do that, Priscilla, welcome. Nice to see you.
Thank you. Good to see you, Dennis.
Yeah. Before we all get into that, I want to talk a little bit about why you became a nurse.
So medicine is in my family. My father was a doctor. His dad was a doctor. And a few more generations were physicians. And I have a sister who's a doctor as well.
Right. And why home care and all the things you did with that? How did you happen to focus in on that?
I had had my first child and was not happy about the hours I was working at a hospital. And I found an ad for a position at the time, it was the V&A Hospice Alliance, based in Florence. And it's part what is now Cooley Dickinson V&A and Hospice.
We're talking about Cooley Dickinson in Northampton.
Mm-hmm.
When we're doing a podcast, it's interesting. We find out that a lot of people listen, but they could be in Cleveland. You know, we don't know who's listening.
Right.
So we like to say Northampton or Florence, or so people know where we're talking about. So you just had an interest in that, just intuitively to want to do home care. That just felt right.
It felt right. I loved the hours, but my first day of orientation when I went out in the field and shadowed my preceptor, I knew that this is where I belonged in the home. It felt so normal to be meeting patients where they were and not in a hospital with a Johnny on, stripped of all of their identity, really.
Right. Well, let's talk about advanced care, medical advanced directives. I think a lot of people know or may know about a DNR.
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk about the different levels, and we'll go through the whole thing, because one of the reasons I wanted to have you on is because there have been changes, and you're involved with the state of Massachusetts with the new way of doing things. So let's go back how it was and how it is, and we'll see where we go.
Sure. So right now, and since 2012, Massachusetts has recognized the MOLST form, which is a medical order, like a prescription, that documents a patient's wishes should they be unable to express them themselves. It's appropriate for people who are have a serious illness or advanced frailty. It's not appropriate for someone who's healthy. It's really focused on people who have a likelihood of having a medical event that could mm-hmm. render them unable to speak for mm-hmm. themselves.
Well, how about, because I was looking at, I just did some stuff with a lawyer to get my affairs in order,
yep.
just to have, because I'm not a kid anymore, unfortunately. So I know that I have a DNR.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what do most people, let's talk about what most people should have, and then we'll talk about the specifics of MOLST, which is what you've been working on. What should most people have when they're thinking of, and I know it's uncomfortable to say end of life. Nobody likes to talk about that. But the way I think about it, and I've thought about this for a while, it's scary to think about all this stuff. It's not fun. It's pretty frightening. However, once you do it, and you've officially signed up for it or whatever you're doing, then you just go living your life and you don't have to think about it anymore. So what should most people walking around, how should they plan for possible end of life or when it's end of life? What do they do for themselves or for their kids so their kids know what's going on? Give us an idea about the process.
Yep. Great. This makes me very happy to talk about this.
I knew you would be.
So anybody 18 or older should have what's called a healthcare proxy. In Massachusetts, it's a healthcare proxy. It's a legal document that does not have to be done with an attorney, but it's legally recognized and it's legally binding, in which a person appoints somebody, an agent, a healthcare agent, to make decisions on their behalf in the event they're unable to make their own decisions. A doctor has to determine in writing that you're not able to make your own decisions. So signing up, having an agent and signing that healthcare proxy form does not mean you give up control. You're in charge of your own affairs unless you can't be. And then the agent comes into effect. The healthcare proxy comes into effect. It's called being invoked. It can be temporary or it can be permanent. It just depends on your condition. So the reason why everybody should have a healthcare proxy or have a healthcare agent is because in Massachusetts, it's the only thing that's recognized as able to make significant medical decisions for somebody. So if you go into the hospital and you don't have a healthcare agent and you have a cognitive issue, say you have a stroke and you can no longer speak for yourself or you can't make your own decisions, and you say you have children, your children do not have the right by being next of kin in Massachusetts to determine what your next steps are. They can make, you know, emergency decisions. But in terms of long term, if you're in the hospital and you need to go to a nursing home, for example, and you don't have a healthcare agent, you would have to, the hospital would have to go to court to get a guardian appointed. So the healthcare proxy at 18 and older, you don't have to be sick. You just have one if you're 18 and older so that you have someone you trust who can make those decisions for you.
And then how do you do that? In other words, somebody says, okay, I hear Priscilla Ross talk about the healthcare proxy, but so what do I do? I know I got to have one, so what do I do? Do I go to a best friend, or what do?
You choose someone you trust. And I know that there are some people out there who do not have the relationships to have an agent, but most people do. So most people should find someone they trust, someone that they trust will carry out what matters to them, not to the person that they pick, and ask them if they will do it. It could be a big job. You're making important decisions, but after having an agent and having a healthcare proxy, the next most important thing you should do is talk to that agent. So number one, the agent should know that they're your agent. And number two, they should know what matters to you and what you would want so that what they're doing is not actually making decisions. They're just carrying out what mm-hmm. you've already told them you would want.
Okay. Now, part of that is the DNR, the Do Not Resuscitate. Explain that.
So in Massachusetts, they recognize the MOLST. Right now, it's the MOLST, and that is a form that is completed. It's a paper form. It's completed by hand by a physician. It can be by a physician, a nurse practitioner, or a physician's assistant. It's intended to be completed after a conversation or conversations with the patient who has a serious illness, and it documents whether they would want to be resuscitated or not. It can document if they want to have a feeding tube. It would document if they wanted to just be kept comfortable. So that's the purpose of the MOLST form. And what that form does is it communicates to EMS what to do if they come into a situation where you are down without a pulse or respirations. So mm-hmm. this is for extreme emergencies. Mm-hmm. But it tells them what to do. Do you resuscitate or do you not? Right. In the absence of a MOLST or if it's not a complete MOLST, they resuscitate.
Right. How about, well, originally it was something else, right? It was pulsed. So it changed.
No, right now it's MOLST and it's been MOLST since 2012. But in 2022, the legislature passed a statute that to transition the state from MOLST to pulsed. Pulsed is a portable medical order similar to the MOLST. However, It's based on best practices and national standards, and it has very clear boundaries and definitions of who's appropriate and how you go about completing the post. So it's standard practice. It's based on research and best practices. So the state has opted to move from MOLST, which was is important, and I'm grateful that we have it, but to a more standardized process with the post. Mm-hmm. In addition, we will be creating an electronic registry for this post form. And the reason we're doing that is because the feedback that we got in our focus groups and our studies with EMS, emergency department providers, and many others, was that they didn't feel like they could trust the MOLST because there's so much opportunity for error when you have a handwritten form. And oftentimes they would go into a patient's home and there would be three or four, and they're not sure which one is the most accurate and which one they should follow. So with this registry, the forms will be accessible by EMS and by any healthcare provider in the state. If the form is in there, they will be able to find it. Mm-hmm.
Now, should the average person go to their doctor to get that form and fill it out and talk to the doctor? Is that what most people should do?
Anybody who has a serious illness, and the surprise question that we tell people to think about, and this is not just us, this is sort of the national post and throughout most hospices, but for post, the question is, would you be surprised if your patient died within the next 12 months? And if the answer is no, I would not be surprised, then it's appropriate to have a conversation with this person about their diagnosis, their prognosis, what their treatment options are. And if it's appropriate, then complete the post with their knowledge and after the conversations.
So if I'm understanding correctly, if somebody's in good health, somebody doesn't have to go to the doctor to... In other words, nobody knows what's going to happen tomorrow or next week, or you get hit by a bus tomorrow. Who knows, mm-hmm. right? So people shouldn't go to their doctor and fill that out in advance? That's not something that most people do?
That's not what POLST is for. But what you can do is if you're healthy and you you don't have to have a healthcare agent, but you should if you can, you can do an advance directive. So an example of an advance directive would be five wishes or a living will. Now, in Massachusetts, and so what those do is it documents the same things that a POLST documents, but it can be more in more detail. And it is basically a guide to your family or your agent and your medical providers for what you would want. It's not legally binding in Massachusetts, which is why it's so important to have a POLST if you're seriously ill. Mm-hmm. However, having that document where you've thought about and documented what your wishes are is a very good way to ensure. I can't say it would ensure, but it will bring you as close as possible to confidence that your wishes will be honored. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's a really uncomfortable thing to think about. I mean, most people, you don't want to think about the end of life and you don't want to think about bad things. So, but I think it's important to have the conversation, right? Just to have somebody think about it and think, what do they want to do? I think that it's a hard conversation, but I think it's pretty darn important.
There are hard conversations, but if you think about it differently, put it in the context of, instead of thinking about it as being end of life and thinking about my end of life, think about it as, taking control, having control, and making sure that what your choices are honored. And that is empowering. And that gives you control by having that form and having your documents in place. You know, and you have people who will know. Because the other important thing is for your healthcare proxy, they've got to know what your wishes are, right? They need to know.
Right.
Doesn't do them any good if they don't know what it is.
Right. So it really is. Has this been interesting for you? You did this as a member of visiting nurses, and you got into this for the state. This is a whole different thing for you. How do you feel about this? How's that been for you, doing something totally different than the actual home care?
Yeah. So I work for the Executive Office of Aging and Independence, or AGE. It used to be the Executive Office of Elder Affairs, but our name changed about 6 months ago. And it's a huge shift from the kind of work that I was doing before, working in healthcare, in the industry, through COVID. And so I was ready for a change. And I saw this job posting, and I just, it felt like it incorporated all of the things I've done in my life and the things that I haven't been able to move the needle on. I felt that no matter how much education we did in the community and with community members, with medical providers, we just couldn't move the needle in a way that would, that was, we couldn't see improvement in the patients having the MOLST form when they come in, having the serious illness conversations with their providers when they were very, very ill. And this is my opportunity to actually move the needle. So it's mm-hmm. really exciting.
So you feel like you're really doing something. So what is your job now? I mean, yep. obviously this, I guess this is part of your job doing this today, getting the word out, but what are you doing like daily to get the word out? What do you have to do?
So I'm called the Pulse Program Director.
Big title, big title.
And my role is to facilitate the transition from MOLST to the POLST and to stand up an electronic registry. So I coordinate that stuff. So I have other people on my team. We have a vendor who has created the registry for us. We're in the process right now of testing it. We have five healthcare organizations throughout the state who've become, are willing to be our pilot participants or development partners. And they're helping us test the system itself. And we also have advisors and subject matter experts throughout the state who are helping us develop our program. What should it look like? Mm-hmm. I think that what I really like about this job is that we are able to include our stakeholders. We must include our stakeholders in order for this to be a success.
Right.
It's a big shift. It's an IT project, but it's also a clinical project because mm-hmm. it's not just about having a form in a registry. It's about also making sure that our providers, our medical community has the tools it needs and feel confident in identifying patients who are appropriate for POLST and then having those conversations, because that's what we hear from providers is mm-hmm. they don't feel comfortable bringing it up. Mm-hmm. So let's get them the training they need so that they feel comfortable with it. And then they can have these honest and serious conversations with their patients and then document it if it's right. appropriate.
So I just want to recap somebody listening. So somebody listening today, if they have none of the official things that you've talked about, the first thing they should do, they should have a healthcare proxy.
They should have a healthcare proxy. Okay. Everybody over 18 should have a healthcare proxy.
Okay.
Then if you're healthy, but you know there's certain things you would or would not want for treatment, then have an advanced directive like I had mentioned, a living will or five wishes. Again, that's not legally binding in Massachusetts, but it's still a great guide for anybody who might have to make decisions on your behalf. And then if you have a serious illness or advanced frailty, then you move to having conversations with your medical provider about having a POLST mm-hmm. and completing that so that your wishes are honored.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so this is something that I think everybody should do if you're over 18. And if somebody is listening today and they say, yeah, but this is really depressing. Yeah, but if you get it done, then you don't have to think about it, right? You just do it and you go on with your life. Now, it's interesting talking to you today because we're talking about this serious possible end-of-life situation or being in control of your life. And in nursing, it's obviously serious, and it's not fun to talk about. I mean, we're talking about really end-of-life kind of things. Okay, we know that. But now we're going to switch gears because we're going to go from what could be uncomfortable to something that, for you, I know, is very comfortable because away from nursing, you do something that is really fun and is satisfying, and it's the Florence, Massachusetts Community Band.
Yep.
Which is wonderful. I guess I could just say, tell us about it. You could talk for 25 minutes. I know that. But how did the Florence Community Band start? And when did it start?
Yep. So we are coming up on our 25th anniversary.
Amazing,
next spring, April 2026. We will be 25 years old. which I can't believe. So the way it got started is kind of funny. I was going over to Belchertown, Massachusetts for their community band, which is a summer community band. And I had three kids, young kids. And I thought, wow, this is a lot of work driving 45 minutes each way to have a band practice and then a concert. I thought, and I grew up being in community bands. My dad was the director of community bands. I've always been involved in either school bands or community bands. So, and I had this music from my dad. And so I thought, wow, maybe I should start a community band because Northampton, Massachusetts doesn't have a community band. And my husband was at a barber shop and he was talking to his barbers, and the barber was saying, you know, our town really needs something new, infuse some energy in it. We need a marching band. And my husband said, that's funny. My wife was just talking about starting a community band. And from there, Mike Flynn, the barber, wrote a letter to the community, and we got a bunch of donations that came in, and we started our band with 10 people at the first rehearsal.
That's amazing. Now, I know you play instruments. Your instrument of choice, I just found out today, was piano, right, I think? And then you said flute?
Yep.
I always wondered why it's always a flautist instead of a flutist. I don't understand why that is. I wake up in the middle of the night and think of these things. Why is it a flautist?
I always thought that, too. And then I can't remember if it was Jean-Pierre. I think it was Jean-Pierre Rampal who said, I don't play a flout. I play a flute. I'm a flutist.
Right, right. Because I've heard people say flautist.
Yeah. That's a proper
term. I know, it's weird.
And I do not, by any stretch of imagination, consider myself a flautist. I used to play the flute. I can pick it up and play it okay now. Yeah. So I was never a virtuoso.
Thinking about all the serious things we were talking about before with your state job, but doing this with music has got to be, for you, pretty therapeutic. Well, I mean, it's got to make you feel good, and it's very positive.
It's cheaper than therapy, I got to say.
I got
it's not
you. I
necessarily
got
easier, but it's cheaper you. Than therapy. This band has been an amazing community for each other and for me as well. And there's so many connections to my childhood. You know, there are days when I take out my score and I see my dad's writing on it, or days when we play a piece that will harken back to my childhood. There's music that we're now playing that is representative of typically underrepresented composers. So that's really exciting that we've been getting grants that allow us to purchase music to support young, contemporary, diverse composers. And it's just an amazing community. We have, I think our email list is over 240 people. And our rehearsals usually have 45 to 50 people at them.
Mm-hmm. And all different ages?
All different ages. Our youngest is probably 21. And our oldest, I think, is 90. I'm not sure. We had someone in his 90s, but he unfortunately passed away.
Right. How about, being director, I know I've been in a few amateur choruses. And I know that they're all different people with all different talent levels and all different egos. So you have to be a really skilled person to make that happen.
Thank you. Well, the good thing about community band is there are very few egos. They really do leave them at the door because they're doing it because they want to. They're all volunteers. Nobody's paid. There's no auditions. There's no dues. People are coming because they love it. So I have to create an experience at every rehearsal that makes them want to come back. And make me want to come back, too. Of course, we have some days. Last Wednesday, I wasn't quite as fun as I usually am. But we, in general, it's fun. There's no point if it's not going to be fun. But I also want us to be good.
And so, how often do you perform?
We perform 5 to 6 times a year, depending on what's going on. We always do a holiday concert, and we always do a spring concert, and we always play for the town fireworks. And we usually do a concert at the town music series. And we usually do a fall concert as well.
Who picks the music?
I do.
And how do you go about doing that? What's that process like? I've always been interested in that because you're trying to appeal to all different kinds of people. And the Northampton area is a very eclectic area. all different kinds of people, a lot of freelance musicians, a lot of everyday people. So give me an idea of how many, let's say in a normal performance, how many different pieces do you play?
9 to 16, depending on the length of the performance. So sometimes we just do like a 45, 50 minute concert, and sometimes we do two halves. So it would be, you know, about 6 or 7 pieces each half. I picked the music. So we have a huge list. We got a spreadsheet with all of our library on it. And I track what we play every year. So some of it is just going through and just narrowing it down by things we haven't played in 3 or 4 years. I always make sure we have something that's going to appeal to an older crowd, something that's going to appeal to a younger crowd, making sure that we have something that's not very hard, but still not overly simple to hear, to listen to. Always have a musical, and we always have a march. And then I usually pick one piece that is a real challenge, because I want the people who are more skilled as musicians to feel like they're challenged in each rehearsal. So that's pretty much how I do mm-hmm. it. And then sometimes it's just what I feel like playing.
Mm-hmm. Can you give us an idea of some of the things you play?
So right now we are working on our summer music series, and we are playing, a medley of Guys and Dolls.
Love Guys and Dolls.
Yep. We're playing Amparita Roca by Jaime Texidor, who is a Spanish composer. It's a march. We're playing The Klaxon, which is also a march by Henry Fillmore. We are playing a lovely piece called One Life Beautiful, written by Julie Giroux. It's a contemporary piece. It was actually donated by a band member anonymously to the band in memory of my niece, Mary, who died in June of last year. She was 32. And we're playing that for our concert coming up in June. It's a beautiful, beautiful piece. And gosh, what else are we playing? Oh, we're playing In the Mood. So always make sure we have some swing music. And I can't remember off the top of my head the rest.
That gives us
so that's an idea. I try and get a bunch of different genres in,
right?
Different levels of experience, and yeah, go ahead.
So, how much as the director, the leader, how much time do you have to put in away from actually being at a rehearsal?
I would say 1 or 2 hours a week on average. Mm-hmm. There's some weeks where I'm doing a lot more, but I have a tremendous group of people who, a board of directors and a librarian who is amazing. And I'd say that pulling the music together, so picking the music is easy. The hard part is getting all of the music together and all the parts together and get it ready for the band to play it. And that's our librarian, and she's a rock star.
You need her. You need everybody.
I need her.
It's a community thing.
Yeah.
Well, you answered part of it, but I was going to say, what's the best part about being the director, and what's the worst part?
So the best part is when, any rehearsal that goes well is amazing. But I have to say the pinnacle of performances to me, what am I trying to say? The best part of being a conductor is in a performance when the band comes together as one organic group, and the piece comes out in a way that we've never played it before, and the best way we've ever played it, and the most emotional way that we've ever played it. And I can tell that because the hair stands up on my arms. It's actually happening right now, just thinking about it.
Well, it's funny you should mention exactly what you just did, because I'm not a musician. I like choral music, but I've done a little bit of it, not much. I don't read music. And I've been in a few volunteer shows in Northampton. There was a volunteers in Northampton schools, and a lady by the name of Noreen Tiley, who I don't know if you knew her. She was the director. She was wonderful, and she was great with people. And I will never forget, and I wouldn't have mentioned this except what you just mentioned about hair standing on each other. At the end of all of her shows, she would have everybody on stage for a finale do What I Did for Love from A Chorus Line.
Yep.
And even sitting here now, I get goosebumps because I remember standing next to somebody and you worked on this thing for 6 or 8 weeks. And we're all, you have some really good musicians, I'm sure, but most of the people I was with, there were a few good people. Most of us were hackers. You know, we just wanted to do it, raise some money.
Love it.
We loved it. But that feeling of when you get it right or almost right is, you can't even describe that. It's a feeling, it's like you just said, hairs on hairs standing up, right?
Yeah, yeah.
That's what makes it kind of all worthwhile.
Yeah.
Well, listen, I'm so glad we got a chance to talk about the serious things of advanced directives and pulsed and all of that. That's interesting.
But you wanted to hear about my worst thing, too.
Oh, your worst thing.
The worst
sure.
thing.
Go ahead. Go
we
ahead.
Got to talk about that because this is what happened last week.
Uh-oh.
This week. It's when I lose my patience. That is the worst thing about it because I love it. And if I come in the door with something and I don't leave whatever's happening behind and it shows by the fact that I lose my patience. And for me, losing my patience is not that bad. I don't yell. I don't like to do that. And it doesn't happen very often, but that's the worst part of being the conductor is when I lose my patience.
Well, obviously it doesn't happen enough to make you not do it. Because you've been doing it for, what did you say?
Almost 25 years.
Which is an amazing achievement when it started from... See, I always knew that in barbershops there was good conversation. The local barber, you know, that's cheap therapy too.
Yep.
I think most people go to a hairdresser or go to a barber. I don't think they go there for the haircut. They go there for the conversation and opinions and maybe learning about there should be a local band, right?
Right.
Right. Well, this has been terrific. I really enjoyed gabbing with you. You've really given a whole bunch to the community in nursing and now with this new advanced directives and certainly with the Florence Community Band. And Priscilla, thanks so much for being us here. Priscilla Ross, it's been a real pleasure. And keep that band going and keep those directives flowing and we'll all be happy.
Thanks so much, Dennis. This was great.
This is Dennis Lee. Thanks for joining us for the Backyard Oasis podcast. This concludes today's podcast. We're always looking for new ideas, so feel free to reach out to Judy Raper, Associate Dean of Community Engagement at Greenfield Community College at 413-775-1819 if you have an idea you'd love to share. Special thanks to the creators of Backyard Oasis, Denise Schwartz, Chad Fuller, Dennis Lee, and Christine Copeland. Have a great day.